You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast, Ancient Asides Edition. My name is Coyle Neal, and I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me is Jordan Poss, instructor of history, Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina. We're two underslept teachers. Jordan, how's it going?
I think you just summarized it. I was telling you beforehand, I was looking forward to be able to say on this podcast that I'm recording from my office. Didn't pan out that way. Today I was able to leave after some training and come home, so I'm recording at home. But I do have an actual office now, full-time, which is awesome and also exhausting.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Thank you.
I am in my office. I came in to get some sleep because I have a sick infant at home. So
yeah.
I was like, I told the wife good luck with that and came in to podcast and then catch a nap.
Well, Greenville is about the pollen capital of the world. So, I mean, we've all been basically on a carousel of, sinus stuff the last 2 months. So, yeah, I'm right there with you.
I suppose we shouldn't complain too much because we don't have it as bad as the early church did, which is the general topic today. So we, in the last one of these, whenever it went up, we're recording these. This has been, about a year since we recorded the last one, and just who knows when these are going to post. But in the last one, we went through some of the Gospels, and we promised that we would continue through Acts, which is a promise that we're going to sort of keep, but neither of us are biblical scholars, so we'll leave that largely to Nathan Gilmore. But the book of Acts and the New Testament in general are obviously not historical sources in the sense that they're not concerned with the government and politics of the Roman Empire, right? They are concerned with history, particularly Acts. It claims specifically this is the Acts of the Apostles of, and so on. It's a history of the faithfulness of Christ to the church. But anything in there that's political or that's, historical in the sense we generally think of history is really incidental. Which isn't to say it's not accurate, right? From what I understand,
right.
Most of the book of Acts is, even those incidentals are somewhat telling. So I've I've not gone through and sort of confirmed this example by example, but I have heard it said that basically every political office that Luke mentions is appropriate to the time and place. So you might have, these would be all different words in Greek, but you might have a mayor in one city and a big man in another city and a,
prefect.
Yeah, prefect in a third city. I've heard that used apologetically, if this is a later document that someone is going back and sort of making up 50, 60 years down the road, you would just use one office for all of those cities, or you would use the later offices, right, whatever the current office at the time was. But Luke gets them all right.
Right, and as an author of historical fiction, that is a very difficult thing to do, even with the resources I've got to electronically research, just little local institutions and things like that.
Right, because you need not only you need to know not only what the proper institution is, but what the name of it was, 50 years ago.
Right, and the Roman Empire's administration their administrative apparatus was incredibly flexible and adaptable to local circumstances.
Right.
So, I mean, you're going to get variations. They were not Napoleon with, his unified, kind of centralized Napoleonic code enforcing it everywhere uniformly regardless of local circumstances. The Romans, like the Persians before them, are very, very open to keeping the peace by honoring as much local tradition as they possibly can, without threatening their overlordship. So, I mean, that gives you lots and lots of leeway and lots of local variation. I mean, it makes it's a testament to their, it's one of the reasons they lasted so long. It also makes it very hard to speak in general terms about what things were like specifically on the ground, because the Romans, as we've probably talked about before, I can barely remember what we've said on these podcasts up to this point, but as we've probably talked about before, that their adaptability and their willingness to just kind of borrow and steal ideas from other people and customs from other people, is part of why they endured.
Yeah, and honestly, I think that some of that is a problem on our end as well, because of course when mm-hmm. you're translating into English, and again, I didn't go through and you know read my English translations of Acts with an eye to this, but there are only so many ways you can translate these offices into the English language,
right.
And you certainly don't want the translation to get too bogged down in these the specific details of each city. When you're reading through in English, I from what I sort of vaguely remember, it's often, the mayor of this town, even though the word in Greek may be completely different from the mayor of that other town, you just say mayor in all of those places to keep the
equivalent concept. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing to point out. Oh, if you don't mind, speaking of the historical sources, that's a good place to point out that, Luke, I accept that a guy named Luke wrote Luke and Acts. I mean, I know that some people kind of hedge a little bit and say the author of Luke, right. Whatever. The author of Acts is, if it is Luke as is traditionally ascribed to him, he's a Greek guy coming out of the Greek literary scene and using Greek literary models. And history to the Greeks from Herodotus onward was literary. It wasn't simply a matter of, Leopold von Ranke kind of style scientific archival research. They wrote with a eye to being read or listened to in the case of a lot of the early historians who actually were recited. I mean, they'd have public readings. And one of the advantages of that, as I tell my students, is that old historians are still good to read because, unlike modern historians, they were obliged to be interesting. And they also were obliged to follow accustomed literary models, and when you write literature, part of the art of that is knowing what to leave in, what to leave out, and to have a streamlined, focused narrative. And you see that with Acts. I mean, like you said, they leave out anything that is not immediately relative to the, or excuse me, anything that is not immediately relevant to the theme, which is the work of the Lord in the Acts of the Apostles.
Right.
So I mean that's fitting right there with the historiographical model of the time as well.
Right, and obviously we can see that. So to expand it a little bit beyond Acts, Paul is at least somewhat familiar, and the other New Testament authors are at least somewhat familiar with the importance of those kinds of themes when they pick up and run with the themes as examples. So, Paul, mm-hmm. To the best of my knowledge, there's very little politics in the epistles, other than the direct commands to do things like obey the government, pay your taxes, pray for the king, and so on. But right. he uses the language of citizenship at times as a model, right? He's not writing a history per se, but he's willing to take the ideas and run with them. So yeah, the example of being a soldier, right? Again, that works its way into the texts, even if he's not writing a straight line narrative, the tropes are still there. Probably not the right word, but
right.
Not a literary critic. In fact, we actually had a chapel speaker earlier this week who said that he, from his understanding, kind of the big four were athletics, citizenship, military service, and agriculture, which of course are all kind of dominant themes in ancient literature. Pick mm-hmm. up your Roman writer of choice, and all of those things are going to be there. Maybe with less of an emphasis on athletics. That's more of a Greek thing, but again, clearly.
Well, even in the Aeneid, you've got boxing matches and things like that. But again, that's borrowing from a Greek model.
Well, rather than get too bogged down in stuff that neither of us are experts in, anything else to add on Acts or sort of the New Testament in general? Otherwise, we're going to jump into something we can talk more about because no one knows anything about it.
I did think of one thing. We kind of recorded the last episode in chunks, and I remember the last chunk we recorded included our book recommendations, and I forgot a really important one that I wanted to recommend, so I'll get that out of the way here before we jump ahead. Richard Bauckham, who I believe is at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, a really great book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And again, as we pointed out, I'm not a scholar of Aramaic or Greek, but I have read it. And as far as I can tell, as a non-expert in his field, he makes a very, very convincing case for the early dating of the gospel narratives, and especially for their inclusion of what is apparently eyewitness material. So, I mean, he goes back to the idea of Q, Kvela, this now lost possibly like saying source. And basically, his basic argument is that anything not common to all four Gospels, literarily, based on comparison with contemporary literature at the time, they didn't have footnotes, they didn't use quotation marks, things like that, but they did have ways of indicating who the source for particular stories were. So, for instance, he would say that a lot of the material, if I remember correctly, from a lot of the independent material from Mark, I think he speculates comes from Peter.
Right.
It's been a couple of years since I've read it. John, of course, has the most distinct, you know, the most distinct content of the four. Those come from he ascribes them to the various sources, sort of chipping in new material not previously written in the other Gospels. It's kind of a heavy read sometimes because it is scholarly, but it is really, really good, and I think makes a very compelling case for, if not the historicity and the accuracy of the Gospels, at least their provenance, which I think is an important question. He has, if you're interested, he also has written the Very Short Introductions volume on Jesus. So Jesus, A Very Short Introduction from Oxford UP. I've read that. It's essentially a 110-page précis of a lot of his arguments from Jesus and the eyewitnesses. So that's a really, really good introduction to it from kind of, if you want to take it from a slightly less scholarly, but still very well-written tack. It seems like I had a third one in there, but I can't remember what it is, so probably best to move on.
I'm a little surprised we left out Bauckham. I mean, that's sort of the kind of the new classic work.
Yeah, I meant to include him last year. Yeah, and I just forgot. Not last right. year, last
well,
time.
Well, yeah, last year at this point.
Yeah.
Again, there's obviously much that could be said politically about the New Testament, but in terms of politics and history and all of those sorts of things, it is it's historical in the sense that it is largely eschatological, right? I mean, the view of history is that history will have an end, and how do we live in it in the meanwhile? But filling in nuts and bolts, unless you're like a hardcore dispensationalist or a hardcore preterist, the history is beyond the purview of a lot of what's going on. So Nathan Gilmore, take it away from there. moving them from the textual documents of the New Testament. The stretch of history from, I guess, what, roughly 50 AD, 60 AD, somewhere in there, through 160, 170 AD is the least well-documented period in church history, right? We have this 100, 150-year stretch of time where we have a scattering of writings, largely the Apostolic Fathers and Justin Martyr, that are interesting. So as of our recording date, the last Christian Humanist episode was actually on First Clement, which is fantastic. Right. Everyone should go and read First Clement. But again, it's...
That was a really good episode.
Oh, yeah, it really was. And it's... But the letter itself is in some ways kind of frustrating because it doesn't really fill in any blanks. It's largely taking stuff from the Bible, of course they wouldn't have called it the Bible yet, but it's taking stuff from the Bible and pasting it together in different order and sending it again as a mm-hmm. letter to the Corinthians. And that's kind of largely what we've got. There are a few exceptions here and there, but we just don't know that much about history, which means that by the time we see things like the institutional church or dogma, doctrines that are set down, the canon of scripture and so on, they're not fully formed, but they are well formed. So trying to figure out what's going on in the church in this stretch of time would be sort of the equivalent of reading the United States Constitution, coming cold to American government, reading the United States Constitution, and then reading a book about the presidency under George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump, and then trying to figure out what happened in between. Right. So we know some of the end, and we don't even know all of the end, but we know some of the church in the 200s and 300s. But at that point, the church has been around for two centuries. With that said, there are still a few things that we can sort of hit in that stretch of time. Probably the most important is persecution, because it's the most important. I think we should save it for last. I don't want to say this is least important because that's going to anger everyone, but some of the issues that are not as well documented, maybe that's a good way to put that, but are still relevant. The sacraments would be certainly be a big one, right? Baptism and the Lord's Supper. So in terms of baptism, and feel free to jump in here, Jordan. I'm sort of skimming through notes from my ancient Roman government class. So kind of the big three questions about baptism that the early church, from what I can tell, never really agreed on. Agreement comes much later. The question of who should be baptized, right? Which of course still divides Christians. When we talk about, you know, who should be baptized, we usually mean infant baptism. In the early church, they tended to talk in terms of not so much who should be baptized, but at what point in their life should they be baptized. Specifically, right. there was apparently a trend of waiting too long to be baptized, being baptized at the end of your life instead of at the beginning.
Well, that's one of the arguments about Constantine, because he was baptized on his deathbed. So the question there, and we're getting ahead of ourselves considerably here, but one of the questions with Constantine is, how sincere was his conversion? It's like, well, he wasn't baptized until he was dying, but that was fairly common. So again, it leaves open more questions than it really answers.
Right. Well, and that's sort of the general trend is what we find is that, you know, books written about and scholars who talk about this stretch of time tend to sort of read themselves into it. So if you read a book about the early church by a Baptist, they're going to be baptizing only believers.
And if and wearing
by
ties.
A Presbyterian, grape juice only, right? And if you're if you read a book by a Presbyterian, then they're baptizing infants and on and on and on.
Yeah. A lot of these sources are really open to inference.
Sure.
And you can't. That's part of the. You were talking about First Clement, and I was. We were talking before the show about. I gave my students, among other excerpts from this time period, the martyrdom of Polycarp, which is usually dated to around 150. That began as. It's the story of a martyrdom, but it was circulated apparently as a letter because it's written in the format of a letter. Like, you know, you wrote to ask what happened to Polycarp. You know, the saints tell you this is what it was. This is part of the frustration of reading other people's mail. And we get that with Paul's epistles as well. I mean, I think Gilmore on the Clement episode mentioned that, we know of at least three letters to the Corinthians that Paul wrote. We have two, but there are allusions there because when people are writing to each other, they can freely just allude to stuff that they both know that they both they don't have to explain it to each other. 2,000 years on, that conversation is suddenly almost opaque. Because it is so, the circumstances in which the letters were written have become, those circumstances are lost. And so that is one of the reasons that it is so fraught to interpret this stuff, like you were saying before.
Right, which doesn't stop people from trying.
Oh, no. Especially because the stakes are so high.
Right. And when all else fails, listener, go with the Baptist interpretation. Baptists love church history, let me tell you.
I can't endorse that. I grew up Baptist. I'm in a non-denominational church right now.
That's sort of second best. If you can't go Baptist, go non-denominational.
Well, I feel like that makes me sort of like the agnostic of evangelicalism. It's like I should really choose and land somewhere, but. Yeah, my wife and I were I was in a membership class last weekend, and they said some stuff about the kind of church, the church statement of faith about baptism that I was just like, that sounds really backwards to me. And so Sarah and I talked about this for probably an hour and a half. That's kind of reopened some questions for me about certain things. But yeah.
Well, yeah, and that's reading the sources we have from the other church won't help you, right? Aside from Scripture, of course. I'm not saying that about the Bible, but in terms of trying to figure out what on earth the church fathers thought in the second and third centuries about these subjects. I mean, they're like you said, they're assuming a lot that they don't record. Or they're disagreeing with each other in ways that don't actually give us anything. So
and we know we've lost a lot. Not to get back on the texts again, but I mean, Bauckham starts his book by talking about Papias, who we've only got fragments of Papias, right?
Yeah, I think they're longer fragments, but still just fragments.
It's not like the teeny tiny fragments of like some of the first century gospels that we've gotten, like, you know, these tattered papyri. Right. But no, Papias we've got only in like fragments and quotations, I think, and we know that there was a lot more to him. But because he was alluded to in other texts that continued to be circulated, and he was sort of taken for granted, we've got a second generation Christian source that's, unless we dig up something in a monastery in Egypt or something anytime soon, is gone, which is right. Frustrating.
Oh, sure. So the challenge is hammering through this. One thing that they tend to agree on when it comes to baptism is how to baptize. Mm-hmm. So again, there's a Christian Humanist episode on the Didache, which says this is how to baptize. Give public instruction on all these points. So catechism comes before baptism, which I would use as an argument for believers' baptism. But again, we're Presbyterians would disagree there. And then they say baptize in running water in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. If you do not have running water, baptize in some other. If you cannot in cold, then in warm. If you have neither, then pour water on the head 3 times in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Before the baptism, moreover, the one who baptizes and the one being baptized must fast, and any others who can as well. We see that there's sort of similarity in the method of baptism, right? It's clearly either baptism by immersion when possible, or pouring when you have to, which is, I think, a point of commonality with the church over time. But then you also have the point of disconnect where you have fasting before baptism. I don't know of any certainly Protestant denomination who pursues that. I suppose the Eastern Orthodox might. I don't know much about their traditions, yeah. They're certainly not sprinkling as a method. I think that comes in later once the church moves north. You can immerse in the Mediterranean where cold water is really lukewarm, but you get up in Northern Europe, that's not so safe.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to be baptized in a fjord in December.
Right. just briefly, in terms of the Lord's Supper, what's going on in communion? Sort of the general agreement seems to have been that that part of the service was closed. There was a part of the church service that was open to just anyone who wanted to come, who wasn't a government agent there to find out who people are. So praying, preaching, singing, and so on, were open to anyone who wanted to show up. But before celebrating the Lord's Supper, the deacons would ask anyone who was not a baptized Christian to leave the room, which, as we'll talk about, just adds to Roman suspicion that something creepy is going on there.
Right. Especially all the talk about eating flesh and drinking blood.
Right. But there seems to have been some sort of early church disagreement over what's actually happening in the event itself. So kind of the two broad categories of thought. One approach said that communion is a sacrament. The Lord's Supper is an obedient declaration of what Christ has done for us on the cross. The bread and wine are a copy of the body and blood of Christ, just as, you know, Hebrews says the temple is a copy of Christ's body. That's one sort of a stream of thought. The other stream of thought says that communion is a sacrifice. The idea being that the Lord's Supper is a thank offering based on the Old Testament idea of an offering given to God, not because you've sinned, but just because you want to thank him for who he is and what he's done from the whole congregation to God. These aren't necessarily contradictory positions, but disagreement comes in over which of those matters most. And of course, the sacrifice position over time becomes more and more dominant and gets added to other Old Testament sacrifices. So you have the idea of it being a thank offering sort of expanded until it starts to include the Old Testament offerings of atonement, right? Once the idea of transubstantiation comes along, you then have the idea that this is somehow a part of the work of salvation itself, and that's farther down the road. But we can certainly see seeds of that in the early church. Anything on sacraments, Jordan?
I think fairly well covered it.
Another, again, I hate to call these minor things, because persecution just looms so large in the sources, they are small in terms of the amount of ink spilled by the early church. Two other sort of minor points, again, with the understanding that minor is not a great way to say it. The copying and dissemination of scripture. This is, I think, kind of interesting. So, you know, unlike today, if you need something copied, you can't type it up on your iPad and run it over to Kinko's. Although, I guess I don't know if Kinko's is even open anymore. So
it's now. So, I've been there several FedEx times recently. It's FedEx Office, I think.
Yeah. So, well, it tells you how far behind I am.
Yeah, I feel like it's wrong for me to print manuscripts at school, so I usually wind up at FedEx Office to do it if I feel guilty enough.
Oh, it's, well, you're full time now, so that should be one of the perks, right?
I don't know. I don't know if I can answer that question, or at least not answer it where people are going to hear.
Right. Well, in the ancient world, this burden is largely borne by libraries. Yeah. So libraries would keep, and this is such a weird sentence to say, libraries would keep a large number of educated slaves who for a minimal fee would mass produce basically whatever you wanted them to.
Well, that's college now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, and it was super cheap too, right? It was like 80 cents a copy in modern modern amounts. So one historian says that the system is so efficient that its output equaled that of the printing press in the early 19th century. The early church apparently spent a lot of time and resources having this done, spreading scriptures around to the churches of the world. We can assume this is the case because every letter that we have in that very small set of the apostolic fathers' writings assumes that the church they're writing to have access to the scriptures, right. Including those living in far-flung corners of the empire. So Irenaeus, writing in modern-day southern France, just assumes knowledge on the part of those he's writing to, that they have right. access to the same books he does. Anything to add on copying?
One point I usually hit with my Western Civ students is just that because Christians rely so heavily on such a quantity of texts, very often they prefer the codex for binding purposes. So you start to get the ascendancy of the codex and the scroll starting to kind of go by the wayside at this point. But that's going to be a long drawn out process and not directly relevant to what we've got to talk about. But it is interesting to see that that change occurring. And I think in one of the Christian Humanist podcasts somewhere, David Grubbs alludes to, I want to say it's the manuscript with Beowulf in it, as kind of a custom manuscript, you know. So, I mean, books were basically, all books at this time were essentially bespoke. So it's like, okay, I want a book with, you know, the Gospel of Matthew, as many of Paul's letters as you can copy, the Shepherd of Hermas, and a couple of hymns. And,
right.
you know, it arrives at some point, you know, with this, to us, random assemblage of texts. But, you know, if you get it between the boards of a codex, it's going to last you a pretty good long time.
Right. Maybe even down to the 21st century. I mean, we have a couple of, well, I mean, later ones, obviously, not from this early stretch, but.
Yeah, especially when it comes to papyrus, because it, you know, outside of desert climates, papyrus degenerates within a generation or so.
Right. One last minor air quotes point, church leadership. So again, this is one of those areas where the reporting on this is going to be directly reflective of the beliefs of the person who's writing the book that you're reading. But in the early church, there seem to have been three clearly recognized offices: bishops, elders, and deacons. So again, the Didache says you must elect for yourselves bishops and deacons who are a credit to the Lord, men who are gentle, generous, faithful, and well tried, for their ministry to you is identical to that of the prophets and teachers. Which tells us that at least at this sort of early point, each local congregation is responsible for electing men to fulfill church leadership functions. Which the Baptist in me is like, yes, of course. Why wouldn't they do that? But that's also not all. As churches begin to grow, especially in the major cities of the empire, so Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, Carthage, and before it's wiped out, Jerusalem, they would send out church plants. Unlike when, you know, when a church plan is done today, the leadership of the new church remains the same. So it would be sort of the equivalent of if my church here in Bolivar were to do a church plant, that new church would meet in its own building, but they would keep the elders of the church they left. So particularly the senior pastor would remain the senior pastor. In this case, it would be the bishop, who remains the bishop of both churches. So in the city of Rome, the bishop performed all baptisms and personally blessed all of the bread and wine for communion, which the presbyters would then carry to the congregations scattered throughout the city. The bishops were also solely responsible for the finances of the churches. They would eventually, of course, that leads to all sorts of scandal and abuse.
As it does.
Yeah. To assist the bishops, each church has its own local presbyters and deacons. In theory, all of these bishops are equal. In practice, the bishops over the larger cities gradually exert more and more influence. So great centers of trade and learning are understandably seen as having greater authority. In the earliest part of the church, Jerusalem obviously occupies the position of authority. So the Council of Jerusalem, right? They go there to make their decision. They don't go to Antioch, where you know the name Christian is coined. So Jerusalem sort of seems to occupy that position until the Romans destroy it in 70 AD. Then the center of authority shifts west and rests on Alexandria, Rome, Carthage, and to a lesser extent Antioch. And then once Constantinople is founded, it gets added into the list. But very, very early, Rome sort of grows as the preeminent church in the empire. The capital city's political grandeur and the tradition that Peter and Paul were martyred there quickly leads to Rome being recognized as the greatest of churches, which is interesting because it seems that the Roman church is wiped out several times in persecutions.
Yeah.
But even with that, they keep sort of center stage. So Irenaeus writes... it is a matter of necessity that every church should agree with the Church of Rome on account of its preeminent authority, which is not to say that the bishop is either infallible or has full authority over other churches, although we see seeds of that there, right? An idea that's sort of planted in the early church in the Middle Ages will sort of grow to fruition. Let's see. I think that's probably all I want to say. There's a really interesting stream of letters in not Clement, the guy from Carthage, Cyprian. Cyprian has a stream of letters back and forth between between the congregation in Rome, where there's a schism in Rome. And I don't remember all of the details, but it's one guy had been elected as bishop by the congregation. This other guy said, well, that's not fair. I wanted to be bishop. So he took a large number of people and formed his own splinter church. And then, if I remember right, he sent an email to, you know, like good Baptists do, right?
Yeah, this sounds like rural Georgia.
So he sent, I think I just said he sent an email. No, he didn't send an email. He sent a letter to Cyprian and to the churches in North Africa saying, hey, I'm the Bishop of Rome now. Cyprian was sort of briefly taken in by this until he realized that it was a splinter church situation. Seeing him kind of navigate that, you know, how do you figure out who's the quote unquote real Bishop of Rome is interesting. But Cyprian is sort of his dominant theme is that the church should be unified. And again, as a Baptist, I can agree and disagree with that kind of at the same time. I can say, yes, the local church should be unified. When you start talking, does that apply to every church in town as part of the same church? That's when I say, Cyprian is clearly not saying that his own church in North Africa is part of the Church of Rome. But anyway, there's a lot of discussion that should be had there. All right, I think that's probably all I have to say about leadership in the early church. Jordan, anything to add there?
Nothing productive.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and again, you know, just all of these things, all of these issues, you know, when we get to the persecutions here, which we do have better documentation for, both from within and without the church, all of these issues, the sacraments, particularly communion or the mass, and leadership are going to play roles in that persecution, and of course it's really fascinating to study this period, as frustrating as it can be because of the lack of sources. But as more sources come into it, and the later we go to see the way the church's air circumstances feed persecution, which alters the church in significant ways, particularly with creating the circumstances for new heresies to arise. It's directly because of persecution that you get the Donatist controversy,
right,
which has a bearing on exactly, you know, the efficacy of the sacraments, who has the power in the sacraments, is it really down to the priest or the bishop, The Orthodox answer, of course, is that it's God who works through those things and not the priest, because we're all ultimately unqualified to do that. But all of that, and of course, I'm getting ahead again a little bit because there are so few examples to work from in this early period. All of those things kind of feeding on each other until you eventually get Christianity triumphant in the figure first of Constantine and then of Theodosius, who we will again talk about at some point down the road.
I would imagine both of those gentlemen will get their own episode because they're especially Constantine. I
Julian
mean,
would be a good one too.
oh man, I yeah, he's really fascinating.
I take a moment too to if a listener has not listened to the Flagship Podcast episode, first on the Didache, but especially that recent one on Clement, don't hesitate, go listen to it. It's covering a lot of ground we've just kind of summarized, and that was one of the I've listened to the Flagship show for close to 5 years now, and that's the first time in a while where I was kind of like raw sort of cheering on the discussions because it was so good from so many different angles. I mean, they had differences of opinion that really served to kind of sharpen and inform each other, which made it a really great listen.
Oh, it's a great show. I mean, I enjoy podcasting, and I like. I think we do an okay job. I don't, we're obviously
Oh,
still
y'all are
good at
great.
it, but they're. I mean, they're phenomenal, right? If you are only listening to one show on the network, it should be theirs. And I'm not saying that because they're paying me money, because they're not paying me money. They could if they wanted to, but they're not. It's a great show.
Yeah, I theirs was the only podcast I listened to for several years because I'd never gotten into it. And now that I'm listening, I've probably got 15 that I subscribe to and regularly listen to. I realize how spoiled I was. It's like, I started, they get one out every week and that's not enough. So, I found like some other like religious humanities or literature podcasts, and they're so bad. Like there's one that I'm just barely tolerating, because they occasionally say interesting things, but it's, that podcast is a handful of diamonds in the rough. The Flagship show is mostly diamonds.
After the episode
so.
is over, I want you to tell me what that is. But
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm the one I'm praising is the Christian Humanist
No,
podcast.
I understand that. I'm curious as to what the bad one is, but
Yeah.
They're good podcasts. Maybe there are a lot of good ones out there, and there are just so many they're hard to find. But
Yeah. It's like
at least,
blogs.
right, or at least good podcasts that have any kind of staying power seem to be
Yeah.
pretty few and far between.
Yeah.
Well, we should talk persecution. Jordan, did the Christians have it coming?
In what sense?
Well, in any sense,
Did they,
did
if
they
you mean,
deserve what
did,
they
if you,
got?
it depends on who you're asking, because by Roman lights, yes, absolutely. Because, going back to the very beginning of when we recorded these, we talked about the Mos Maiorum and Roman religious institutions and things like that, and religion, as I make enormous pains to tell my 101 students, religious institutions and political institutions are so completely enmeshed that they are inextricable. It is not simply a matter of, well, you can believe what you want about the gods as long as you don't bring it into politics. I mean, politics is a mode of honoring and worshiping the gods. So by Roman lights, these weirdos who only worship one god, who is a crucified criminal, dying one of the most dishonorable deaths possible in a backwater of the empire that's kind of a pain to keep within the empire. That is, it's not just strange to the Romans, it is destructive, particularly as the cult. And what is a, I packed up my Tacitus because we're rearranging the living room, but Tacitus, I can't remember his exact phrase, but he refers to Christianity in the one reference for the persecution of Nero as some sort of like detestable cult or something like
Right,
that. He's
like a superstition or a.
It's interesting, and we'll talk about this probably more because he does note that there is sympathy for the Christians because their persecution is clearly just scapegoating. But
Right.
he is clearly not in favor of them as a superstition, as a cult. And it's because if you stop honoring the gods, if there is an end of sacrifice, the empire falls. Because the empire is itself one of the deities that you honor.
And let me Let me push back on one point, but first let me applaud you for keeping Tacitus in your living room. I don't even do that. I don't know. I don't know what the wife would think about that.
Yeah.
I guess we do have books in our living room, but they're not Tacitus.
I have a couple of hundred Penguin classics, and they used to line one wall. We're rearranging things though, so they're all in boxes, and it makes me sad.
Yeah. There's nothing sadder than empty bookshelves. That's for sure. I think when we moved to Bolivar from DC, we took pictures of our empty bookshelves and said something like it's sadder than 10,000 weeping puppies, and we didn't get much disagreement. So you said you know the Romans see this as socially destructive, and I think you're right. I mean the social side of it is clearly what they're deeply concerned with, but I might want to push back a little bit. At least my sort of sense is the Romans don't actually care what you believe, right? You know, you can believe in one God, you can believe Jesus was God. They don't care about that as long as you're showing up and, you know, making the public sacrifice and participating in the social stuff. Like, whatever you think in the privacy of your own home, that's your business, and they don't care. But the Christians are not willing simply to have their own private religious beliefs. They insist on it affecting their engaging in these social things. So
right. Which is what I was trying to say, yeah.
Right.
And that's what also where... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say there is a parallel there, right? I mean, it's sort of the argument we're seeing in the modern world where, you know, you can believe whatever you want about, you know, gay marriage, but heaven help you if you won't use your business to bake a cake at a wedding.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's
and what was it that there was that Catholic judge recently that was being, I've just lost the word.
Oh, the appellate judge.
Yes, and you know, somebody said the dogma is loud within you, or whatever that strange phrase was. You know, the idea being that, you know, there are competing claims between your religious faith and the state, and you better honor the state, which is a kind of weird secular resurrection of some of these tensions in the Roman Empire.
Right. It's obviously because there is this blending for everyone in the ancient world, including, of course, the Jews, right? There is this blending of church and state, of religion, I guess, religion and state, to where if you are in the army, right, before you go into battle, a sacrifice to the gods is made.
Right.
If you're a governor, you have your administrative duties, but you also have religious functions. If you're an average citizen, and you go to watch an Olympic event. A sacrifice is made, or you know, if you're an athlete and you want to compete in the Olympic events, a sacrifice is made. And if you're a Christian, all of those things are now off limits, even if the activity itself is fine.
Right.
I don't know of any. I guess aside from a sort of Chariots of Fire situation where you won't run a race on Sundays, I don't know of any Christian groups that don't believe in athletics. And yet they would have to step back from those. So. Christianity is antisocial is certainly the primary reason, right, that the Romans are going to go after them.
Right. A useful parallel. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I mean, a useful parallel, and I want to say somebody on the network recently addressed this. It might have been Danny. I mean, a useful parallel might be, you know, imagine if you're at a football game and instead of the national anthem, you're singing hymns to Apollo and Zeus first thing. And furthermore, the game is played in their honor. It's not just a ritual that you go through. The pervasiveness of that. I mean, it's a ritual, and you know, one I'm increasingly uncomfortable with, honestly. But it's a part of our civic religious ritual that we are so accustomed to. Right. I mean, look at the anger over the whole Colin Kaepernick thing, and without getting into the issue, somebody. You know, refusing to acknowledge the flag during that ritual I've been taking a social media sabbatical, and this is part of the reason why. just the stuff that you see every Sunday when football players take a knee during the national anthem, it is a religious anger, essentially. So imagine that, you know, imagine that applied to, again, the essentially existential necessity of honoring the gods in the ancient world, and you have... You begin to approach some sense of what the stakes are for the Romans and the Greeks.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, if we had, you know, a Colosseum full of lions, these individuals would be in danger of being thrown to them.
Right.
I uh, I'll probably edit this part out, but there's a part of me that really wants Colin Kaepernick to come out and say, look, I stand only for the stars and bars, just for maximum, like maximum infuriating everyone possible. Like he's already got one side, now go for the other side.
Turn everybody inside out. That would be great.
Yeah, I don't think he will, but I don't think he's not in the NFL anymore, I don't think.
I mean,
you can come back to social media now. We've moved on to whatever the next issue is. I haven't seen one of those posts in, you know, 3 weeks. Is that the only reason? What other reasons might Christians be trouble?
Well, we talked about some of the kind of, you know, religious, political, existential issues there. And really quick, something that I stole. I want to say it was Gilmore said it on the flag. Since we're doing all that butt kissing today, I want to say Gilmore said this on the flagship show several years ago, but I've stolen it and use it to kind of tweak my students now, just to get them thinking. Like, there's no such thing as religion in the ancient world, because again, your entire way of life is your religion. It's not a separable post-enlightenment category that you've got over here in this Tupperware container, and you know, your lifestyle's over here and your politics are over here. It's all one great big Brunswick stew. So there's those issues. I've already alluded to it, but Christians were just generally weird. The idea of honoring as a god a man who was crucified, because again, the image of crucifixion is so familiar to us, it's lost a lot of its shock value, frankly. I think we talked about Spartacus probably a year and a half ago. Slaves, non-citizens were crucified. And of course, slaves are essentially inhuman. Even Cicero, who I admire a lot, wrote that, you know, slaves essentially didn't have a life of their own until they became free. They didn't have any life worthy of calling a life prior to becoming freedmen. One of the very early pieces of Christian-related graffiti that they found in Rome is actually a graffito mocking Christianity, showing a kind of stick figure kneeling in front of a cross, and the figure on the cross has the head of a donkey or an ass. And I think the inscription is actually in Greek. I want to say the guy's name is like Philip or something. It's like Philip honors his God, and you know, it's clearly meant to mock a Christian. So there's that aspect of it. There's also like we talked about, Christians are open to sharing what they believe. Obviously, that's been a important part. You know, it's Christ's last command in the Gospels. So sharing, proselytizing, winning people over has been an important part of that. But again, the meetings are to a certain extent closed, and there are closed rituals. And Romans, as we've talked about probably many times before, are extremely suspicious of secrecy. It's one of the reasons they clamped down early on the Bacchae, the Bacchanalia. Even some of the mystery cults that they tolerate, they're still a little iffy on them when they have really, really highly secretive rituals. So what Christianity looks like at first is just another mystery cult with a certain number of secret rituals. But as it becomes more prominent, as it starts to look more like a threat, people sort of look at the language that they're using. And Christians refer to each other as brother and sister. Some of them are clearly married and have children. So the ignorant take this as, you know, whether this is malicious or whether it is a real misunderstanding, it's not clear. But Christians are accused of incest for that reason, like they practice incest. Of course, the very high language of Christ's flesh and Christ's blood in the communion ritual, because it is secret, because it is a closed communion, leads some people to speculate that they really do have, you know, cannibalistic orgies, or you know, in a I don't know how old the blood libel is on Jews, but the fact that Christianity originates within Judaism makes me kind of wonder if there weren't some version of this around already, because there are rumors that Christians kidnap babies and sacrifice and eat them. Right. And a lot of this has to do simply with Roman paranoia about rebellion, which is a constant, and the relative secrecy of Christian ritual. And again, relative there, it's you know, you're welcome to come, we want to tell you what we believe, but there are certain parts that are closed off for members only, and that coupled with misunderstandings and a certain amount of malice engenders just a lot of rampant rumor and speculation about exactly what it is that these Christians get up to when they're by themselves.
Yeah, and all of that combined with what Pliny, I think, calls their obstinacy.
Yes.
Right. So it's they're antisocial, so they're suspect, and they're
right.
Maybe they're doing these awful things, maybe they're not, but darn it, they are just so stubborn.
Yeah.
That
atheists.
Had to punish them. Right.
Right.
It was necessary. Anyone that stubborn must be wrong about something.
Yeah. Heaven help us.
Which I've been teaching this class on the Holocaust, and one of the arguments for the cause of the Holocaust is, you know, it's because of religion, and then of course you have the argument that no, it's because of atheism. So one of the things the students have to sort of sort through is what was Hitler's religion, and that's, you know,
that's always fun.
Yeah, I mean, if students are listening, stop listening now, because, you know, this might be a test question, but basically it's. It's whatever, you know, whatever advanced him most. Like, he was not afraid to steal from anywhere and everywhere to promote himself and whatever his cause was.
Right.
But one of the things he admired most about Christianity was the stubbornness of its members.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Romans look at stubbornness and say, oh, that's terrible, and you shouldn't be so stubborn in society. Hitler looked at it and was like, oh, that's awesome. We should we should be more stubborn than the Christians.
Yeah. But then he takes, you know, but the downside, of course, to Hitler is that, you know, he's kind of. Kind of shares this with Gibbon and Nietzsche, strange bedfellows. You know, the Christians are stubborn, but they're stubborn about being weak, basically.
Right.
So, I mean, in private, and I take the Tischrede, the table talks of Hitler, to be authentic. I think they were transcribed by Martin Bormann. You know, privately, he would, you know, mock Christianity. His own personal beliefs seem to be some kind of stew of spiritualism and neo-paganism with just kind of generic godlessness.
Right.
So, I mean, what he wanted was that stubbornness as the handmaiden of kind of a Nietzschean will to power and, of course, right. racialist politics. Because, not to put too fine a point on it, the nation, the folk, in modern nationalism is a substitute and rival god for any traditional religion. But that's a hobby horse I won't get on right now.
Well, right. And there are parallels with what's going on in Rome.
Right.
I mean, the Romans didn't really care, again, as we said earlier, the Romans didn't really care what you worshipped, as long as you also did their stuff.
Right.
I mean, as long as you are supporting the state, as long as you're doing your civic duty, they don't care.
Right.
Believe whatever you want at home, as long as you're not causing problems, which leads to the stream of 10 persecutions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Give or take, depending on that. 10 is such a nice round number that it has to be a suspect somehow.
Kind of like the numbering of the Crusades. It's sort of it's kind of a convenience imposed on local, unsystematic, and occasional empire-wide systematic series of persecutions. I think it imposes a deceptive amount of a deceptive formalism on what was a little bit more ad hoc. With the exception of some of the big ones.
Right, right. Well, and it's interesting that up until, I forget which emperor it is. I think it's Dacius, maybe Dacius. I don't know how you're supposed to say his name. Maybe even up until Diocletian. Most of the persecutions we have evidence of are not specifically targeted at Christians. So you'll have someone like Septimus Severus or Marcus Aurelius maybe even Dacius is one of these. But the idea is they pass legislation designed to, you know, make Rome great again, to take the Roman people back to the traditional virtues, which includes the traditional religious virtues. Christians, of course, cannot engage in those activities. So they end up being persecuted along with anyone else who refuses. They're sort of the big group left in town. The Jews have been expelled from the empire or enslaved, so they are less relevant. So you don't have explicit anti-Christian regulation coming out until much later.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's on the very local level,
right? And that's the implication of both Tacitus and Pliny, who we've both already referred to. Is there's no indication in Tacitus that Nero persecuted any Christians outside Rome. He just held them.
Right.
He just scapegoated them for the fire in the specific environs of the city of Rome itself. And Pliny, as a governor of Bithynia, I think.
Yeah, Bithynia or Pontus.
I think it's Bithynia, on the Black Sea, anyway. The indication of his handful of letters about the issue to Trajan is that it's kind of just this local thing that he's trying to take care of.
Well, and we just read this in class the other day. It's interesting. He actually says that Christianity used to be a problem, but there's been sort of a revival of paganism. People are going back to the traditional ways, so it's really kind of a mopping up operation,
right?
In his view, which I hadn't caught that the first time or first couple of times I read that. So I'm looking at my notes. The apparently the first sort of specifically counter Christian, like where the Christians are targeted by name was Valerian,
mm-hmm.
Where he went after Christians in the elites of Rome. So senators, military officers, were to be removed from government and lose their dignity and property. Everyone else is to be executed. So that's 257. So that's long beyond our time here.
Right.
So it's a while before Christians are specifically targeted. It's always sort of a general trying to make Rome, general trying to revive Rome to get back to good traditional virtues, and Christians get swept away in it. Or something like Nero, where it's, it's specifically at Christians, but it's localized and it's not personal, right? It's just business. I don't think Nero actually personally hated the Christians. I think they were just a convenient target.
Well, Tacitus, as far as we can rely on Tacitus for this, because he kind of hints at Nero's state of mind here, and it's not clear what evidence he's basing this on. But he heavily implies that he's kind of casting around for a popular scapegoat. Like, okay, who have I heard people don't like? Okay, you, Christians, you're weird, I'll get you. And ironically has the opposite effect.
Well, I think this was in an undergraduate class. Someone had pitched in our class discussion that he originally had targeted the Jews. And was it his wife who was Jewish? His wife or his mother or something like that? I forget which.
I want to say maybe wife? It's been a very long time since I've thought about that.
I should have looked this up.
Yeah.
Reason, like the Jews were sort of the standard scapegoat. But there was some personal reason he had not to point to.
Well, Claudius had already expelled the Jews at least once.
Right. Right. Oh yeah. So if they're already out of town, that would make sense too. Well, there's a lot more we could say about persecution, but we are coming up on an hour, and we both have things to get to. We're not done with persecution by any stretch of the imagination. We've basically talked about the Roman side of it. There's of course the Christian perspective of how do we endure this, and then the more formal targets of Christian persecution as we get into even better sources in later times. Jordan, anything to add about what we've talked about today?
I think we started off by talking more or less about the Book of Acts. Read up some of the later chapters of the Book of Acts. Like we talked about, literarily, Acts is not interested in... Let me put it this way. I gave my students in 101 a excerpt from Acts along with some other sources like Tacitus and Pliny to read. And one of my students, really interestingly, said that he's been a cop for like 20 years. And this is an online course, so I actually haven't met him. But he said he's been a cop for like 20 years, and he was struck in the account of Acts about how loose Roman procedure was. And nowadays they'd never accept an anonymous accusation for something like that. And I did have to point out that that's a good point. Roman procedure, and I did say Romans, as we've talked about, are extremely obsessive about procedure. Romans are very unimaginative in this regard, and they are going to be pretty hidebound proceduralists. You just don't get that from the Book of Acts, because that's not what Luke is trying to convey. You maybe get hints of it, and of course you also get hints at some of the shortcuts that maybe a few people are taking. Felix we were talking about apparently waited 2 years to see if he would get a bribe.
Right. Well, and notice he gets removed.
Something
too,
like that.
Whichever one's waiting on the bribe, they're taken out of office. So there is some idea.
Right.
That...
Or might have just rotated out.
Right.
Yeah. But so read up on.
Oh, as I say, we do have in the letters between Pliny and Trajan where Pliny asks, how should I go after these Christians? And Trajan's reply is, do not use anonymous sources, right? Do not use anonymous complaints. Follow established procedures and so on. So,
basically, if there's a unavoidable, obvious case of someone publicly practicing Christianity or causing trouble, because that was why Paul was arrested in the first place, and that incident was almost causing a riot at the temple, which is something that's going to set off Roman alarm bells every time.
Right.
But to your point, Trajan is essentially giving notes on procedure,
right.
And discouraging the use of anonymous sources, which is always dangerous.
Right. Well, any reading suggestions as we're on our way out here?
Again, I'd say the later chapters of Acts, especially as Paul is arrested and shuttled around, you get a sense of the Romans just not knowing really what to do with him and exactly what these beliefs are. It's clear that they're interested, but he's not particularly a threat yet. And of course, famously, they tell him, if you hadn't appealed to Caesar, we could have let you go. This after, you know, 2 or 3 years of imprisonment. I would also say, again, Pliny and Trajan's letters, the excerpt of from Tacitus talking about Nero's persecution. I'd also say look up Clement and the Didache to get a little bit of the kind of the inside picture. And another source that I gave my students recently was, I think I alluded to it, but the Martyrdom of Polycarp. The dates there are a little loosey-goosey. The general consensus is that Polycarp, who probably knew the Apostle John, right, as far as we can tell, based on some allusions to him and other work, so that makes him a second-generation believer.
Right.
The general consensus is that he was martyred around like 156 AD. So that's getting us kind of to the end of the bracket, the time frame that we've bracketed, and gives you a pretty good picture of what the situation looked like by that point. The Christians, and particularly Christian leadership, are public enough and high-profile enough to be singled out because there are... without giving too much away, it's a relatively short letter that you can read pretty quickly. Basically, there's a potential riot, and Polycarp is called out by name by a mob of rioters as someone that essentially the governor can appease them with if they simply kill Polycarp.
Right.
I'd also say, talking about the growth of Christianity, I can't remember if I've recommended Rodney Stark before. Mm-hmm. He's a pretty interesting guy. I believe he's an agnostic, but he's a sociologist of religion who is associated with Baylor's Institute for the Study of Religion. He's been on their podcast a couple of times and is always worth listening to. I can't remember the title of this book off the top of my head, but I think it's got a white binding, which won't help you if you find a different
right,
edition.
No, that's all right.
He's got a book that basically traces the rise of Christianity. Just look at the descriptions of some of his books, and you'll probably be able to find this one. It essentially traces the rise of Christianity using the best sociological methods available from the data we have available. So what you get is a picture of the church that is primarily Eastern, primarily urban, for the first couple of centuries, just, again, based on the little bit that we can know data-wise from a sociologist's point of view.
Right.
It's pretty short, quick, easy-to-digest book. I'd recommend it.
And I'd suggest, I can't imagine I haven't suggested this one already, but just in case, Robert Louis Wilkins' The Christians as the Romans Saw Them is fantastic. I mean, it's a great book. A more recent book that sort of runs in the same vein is A Destroyer of the Gods. I am blanking on the author, but I did a Profiles interview with
him. Is it Larry Hurtado?
Yes, that's right. Larry Hurtado. Okay. It basically takes Wilkin and expands a little bit on some of his arguments. And then one that I'm pretty sure I recommended last episode, the author's name is Sherwin White, a good British hyphenated name. And the name of the book is Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament. It is a sleeping pill. I think he's passed away now, so I can say that. It's not very long, but it feels like it's, 2,000 pages long. But it is also sort of, if you want to know, why did Jesus' trial look the way it did? Why did Paul's trial look the way it did? Where are sort of the points in Roman law, and why do they go through the path they go through? He walks through just all of the nuts and bolts of procedure and so on. And it's a great little volume to have read once and sort of mind it for details and then never have to go back to it. It's not a fun read.
Yeah. Have I recommended Sarah Rudin's Paul Among the People yet?
Yes, but we can throw it up in the notes again because it's a good one.
Yeah, since we're talking about Paul and Acts, this book is more relevant to this topic. Sarah Rudin is a Quaker classicist who she wrote for Books and Culture a long time.
Okay.
Prior to Books and Culture folding earlier this year or last year. She's translated the Aeneid. I have her translation of the Golden Ass, which is one of my favorite bits of Roman literature. check out her translations. This is a book, though. She comes from apparently a liberalish, Protestantish background. The book essentially examines Paul based on what she knows about other classical literature. Because, again, the modern liberalish stereotype of Paul is that he's kind of a woman hater, you know, he-man woman hater, who is kind of pushing his own radical interpretation of Jesus and all these social mores that, you know, don't really jibe. And you know, he's kind of imposing, he's imposing his Paulishness on us when Jesus came to bring peace and love and open lifestyles or whatever. Rudin essentially says, okay, well, I know Paul, I know Juvenal and Petronius and all of these other classical authors. What do Paul's standards and the message that Paul is bringing look like in comparison with the, frankly, predatory hedonism that you see in something like the Satyricon? I don't agree with all of her conclusions. She takes a more skeptical view of which letters Paul wrote than I did, but, you know, that's her right. She knows the languages and I don't.
Right.
It's a very good work contextualizing Paul and showing that, contrary to that modern image, he is actually a breath of fresh air in the ancient world. He's the first person in ancient literature that we know of to have written the command, "Husbands, love your wives," for instance. We tend to get hung up on when, you know, wives submit to your husbands. The really radical part of Paul is commanding men to love their wives and be true to them. Just that kind of thing. So I would really highly recommend reading that. It's been a few years since I've read it, but it was a pretty revolutionary book for sort of my perspective, both on Paul and on the ancient world.
Well, with that, we should wrap this up. As you can tell by the fact that this ancient episode is a good 40% shorter than the others we've done, that's a sign, I think, not of our lack of intelligence or interest, but hopefully just of a lack of good sources. The next one of these we do, we'll probably be back at regular length, because we're back into good sources and interesting people and Tertullian and Clement and Origen and all of the fun guys do crazy things. With that, Jordan, thanks so much for joining us. And
Thanks for having me again.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please check out the other podcasts in our family. Get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. You can also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. You can also like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, render unto God those things that are God's.